Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. Shooter's ready. Stand by.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Bullets and Bourbon. I'm here with my co-host Frank Gao, and I got a very special guest for you. So Chris Serino, he's been a friend for years. The first time we met was at the 2016 Blue Ridge 3-Gun Championship, and personally, I never watched Top Shot. Even to this day, I still haven't watched it, but everyone that was there was like, that's Chris Serino, and I was just like, who's Chris Serino? You know, so I never really got starstruck or anything. So Chris has a wide range of experience from being a law enforcement officer, a federal air marshal, a firearms instructor, and a TV personality. And I know Chris is a really nice guy who loves helping people, a great shooter, and most importantly, a friend. A lot of our questions are follow-up questions to two episodes from Gun Talk Radio. So if you would like some context, please give them a listen. But instead of listening to me run my mouth, Chris, can you take the time and just introduce yourself?
Hey, everybody. My name's Chris Serino, and I am in Louisiana, Southeast Louisiana, having a blast. My mom just moved in with me, so we're having a good time here. She's sitting in the quiet, watching her Fox News with subtitles while we talk business.
So, you know, the first question is, we all grow up with heroes as kids. Even as adults, we have individuals we look up to. And what I want to know is, who would you say has had the largest influence on your life in growing up and as you navigated your career while in the firearms industry?
Honestly, I look at that question and I think to myself, I don't have any heroes. My dad was probably the closest thing I had because, I mean, he never killed me. And number two, he led by example. I mean, he worked his ass off and, I mean, he didn't have a lot of hope for me, but it worked out okay. And apparently, you know, we all learn in time, but I mean, I knew cops that I never wanted to be a cop, never wanted to be a cop. I had friends that were cops. They were my friends and mentors. And, you know, throughout my years as and everything I've done, I thought about it, you know, and it's like, I've just been surrounded by a lot of really good people. So I don't have a serious hero, man. Does that make sense?
No, it does. You know, what about people you looked up to? Like, I mean, I don't think it's healthy to necessarily idolize somebody, but I think it's important to have people that you get experiences from and learn from.
Well, I had some great mentors when I was working for the state of Ohio, you know, some guys I worked with, one of them being Kevin Davis, who's one of the top, you know, top use of force experts in the country. He does a lot of defense work like that. I mean, one day he told me, he said, listen, you need to start writing. You know what you're doing. You're doing a good job. You need to start writing because somebody has to fill in as things go. So he was a reason I started writing. He said, ass in chair, words on paper. So that's what I did. And then my boss back at the state days, you know, he would always push me out of my comfort zone. There was a lot of things I didn't want to do or didn't think I could do. And he said, you're going to do it. You'll figure it out. And he pushed me. And I mean, I started teaching at conferences and doing things on a national level because of him. And so those definitely are mentors to me. You know, of course I work now with KJ, Kevin Jarnigan, and at Gun Talk, and he's 10 years younger than me, but man, do I look up to him. He is a can-do guy.
Hell yeah. You like it over there now?
Man, it's so much fun. I'm working way more than I would like to probably, but I'm definitely doing really cool stuff. So, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, it's great work if you can get it.
And you're kind of doing a lot of you're doing TV personality stuff still, but you're also covering down on a lot of firearms instruction too, right?
Yeah, I got two classes next week. I got a basic pistol followed directly with a semi-auto operator one. So I'm teaching about definitely teaching one a month, sometimes two a month, sometimes more things a month. It depends. Like if we bring in a company that wants to run a class, sometimes they have me run the class for them because they don't have maybe someone who can do it, or they don't have someone available. So they'll be like, no, you can run the class, you do that. So I have to do that stuff. I mean, teaching has definitely always been my passion. So I enjoy it.
Now, and I can relate, like, the amount of influence you can have on somebody's life just by teaching is unparamount. Like, it you can affect and especially as a firearms instructor, you can affect the outcome of a life or death situation, and you don't even realize that half the time. Just, it's almost an afterthought. You're just there. Hey, I just want to teach you how to get better, how to hit the target. But at the end of the day, you have such an impactful role on somebody's life. You just don't think about that type of stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, I still get every once in a while. I still get the calls, hey, was involved in the incident. I heard your voice, blah blah blah, that usual stuff. But it's awesome because the responsibility for preparing men or women for battle is should never be taken lightly. I mean, it's a real deal.
Yeah. So I think I know the answer to this already, but I want to hear you say it. But being a seasoned competitor, when would you say you were your most successful, and what did it take to get to that level of performance?
Okay, so you know that I've never had my most successful time yet because I was always just out there to have fun and vet my skills. But I can tell you when things changed and I started getting better was when Chris Fleming beat me at the FN match in Virginia. And Chris Fleming doesn't have legs.
That put things into perspective.
Right. It meant that what I needed to do was slow down and just shoot, do my thing and just shoot because Chris Fleming is r walking on magic legs. He has magic legs and he beat me because I'm running around trying to be fast and not doing anything right. And so that was a big deal. And then also I can tell you that shooting with a lot of the pros, because I would get squatted with the pros, which was great because we're all friends now, but I mean early on it was scary. But Kerry DeMatteis used to always tell me, he'd be like, see, just do what you do, man. Do what you do, see, do what you do, which is shoot. And I'm a shooter, so I never was gonna win any speed matches. But consistent mediocrity has kept me out of the bottom.
I remember you saying that before, but you yourself, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't practice a whole lot. Like, anytime you're on the range, it's usually just training people. So when you're at a competition, most of the time you're just relying on, the stuff that you taught people.
Yeah, I don't practice I know it's sad. And I'm going to shoot the world shoot this year, and I'm not going to practice for that. And I always end up in the top 20. I mean, I don't practice. How am I going to practice cowboy action, long range precision? How am I going to practice USPSA? I don't shoot any of that stuff, or wobble trap. I mean, I'll go out and I'll shoot some clays just to refresh myself. And and before every world shoot, if there was one thing I practiced, and it didn't work. If there was one thing I practiced, it was the one-hand bullseye shooting with those 45s. I shake like a chihuahua shitting razor blades. And honestly, I would pull my mulligan every year at the bullseye stuff, one-handed bullseye. And it shouldn't be that way. And I just don't know why I can't do it.
Well, I'll tell you this. I did bullseye for like 2 years, and I would say even practicing For as long as I practice each day, because when we did a summer season on the shooting team, we'd be out there from 8 o'clock in the morning till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon every day for 2, 3 months, just practicing, prepping for, the Inter Service Pistol Championship, prepping for Cannon McKinley, prepping for CMP and NRA Nationals. And you know what? I sucked and I just couldn't get better. And I don't know what it was. Like, I felt like my trigger press was great. I felt like the sights were lined up. I just, I just sucked. But whenever I come back to like stuff that we shoot, three gun, USPSA, I wouldn't say I'm the greatest, but like I'm noticeably better at those disciplines where I'm just going fast and not having to think about it and
I think
just,
it's the slowness of it. The
yeah.
slowness is painful, man. It can make anybody miss.
Yeah, so I mean, I attribute bullseye, and I've said this before, to building my fundamental skills to a higher level, but I just can't do that style of shooting.
I can't do it either. It's not my jam, man. But I am going to shoot the world shoot, and I definitely don't practice. I mean, what am I going to do? Practice cowboy action? I'll probably take a single action pistol out just to make sure I know how to thumb a hammer and work it because honestly,
And you're talking about the NRA World Shooting Championship, right?
yes, it's in Camp Atterbury in Indiana this year in April.
Right.
And I'll be shooting on the pro side because apparently I'm still a pro, even though I'm consider myself semi-pro. I've always considered myself semi-pro, but I'm not there to win. I'm there to have fun and vet my skills as a trainer.
How would you say that competition and instructing correlate with each other? And what advice would you give competitive shooters who want to become instructors? We look at a lot. I run into people all the time who are, they're getting into competition or they've been into competition and they want to jump into the instructing game. But they just don't know how. What advice would you give them?
I would say if you want to be an instructor, it's not the old saying of those who can do, those who can't teach. It is more appropriately said, those who can do, those who understand should teach. Because honestly, man, I mean, when I was an air marshal, I thought one guy said to me, he said, I want your job. I want to shoot like you. And I thought to myself, that's interesting. How do I get him to shoot like me? And why am I good? And I had no idea. So I had to start figuring out what it was that made me successful. And that ultimately made me a better teacher because I had to understand what every time I fire a gun, every time I handle a gun, what is it that I see? What is it that I feel? What are my priorities? As I shoot this gun so that I can make them better, because ultimately, if you can't tell somebody how it is you do something and then morph it so that they can do it, because just because you like it, that doesn't matter. My saying is this: do you like it because you can make it work, or do you like it because you can get other people to make it work? So it's like, oh yeah, you got to have a Glock 40. Great. I'm glad you shoot that well. I suck with a Glock 40 and I wouldn't put it in anybody's hands, especially if they were struggling. But, so you have to think about all that. And then, of course, if you're a competitive shooter already, what makes you think you have what it takes to teach people to shoot guns? Because competition is important, but we can miss a lot in competition. You can miss fast enough. There is such a thing as missing fast enough. I mean, just ask Tony Holmes. He can shoot three rounds and get a hit before I can get one well-aimed shot. But he also knows when he misses, that's how come he can do it so fast. It's like there's so much that goes into it. So you're a competitive shooter. Okay. I mean, so do you have a personality? Do you have the ability to relate to people? Are you going to show them what you do? Or are you going to teach them how to put hits on target? Because ultimately, what it comes down to is hits on target. And if you're doing it standing on one foot, using your big toe to pull the trigger because you're some kind of cripple, who gives a shit? That's all that matters, as long as they hit the target.
Well,
Shooting's not a look. Shooting is a freaking result on target.
Well, I remember what it's been 2 years now. So 2 years ago, I was doing, I guess you can call it an internship at the FBI Academy at their firearms training unit. And, you know, I went in there and I got paired up with a friend who's a friend now, Mike, and he was probably the most seasoned instructor there. And he was, you know, did 20 years at the FBI. He had, you know, local PD time before that. And now he's, you know, probably 5 or 6 years into being an RSO there. You know, just pure full-time firearms instructor. So I'm getting paired with the most seasoned instructor there is. And was I nervous? Not necessarily. Was I a little cocky? Probably, but I went there with a humble attitude saying, you know, knowing, well, I'm coming from the Marine Corps shooting team. I'm, you know, I have all this experience. I have, you know, nearly 20 years of experience in the Marine Corps. So, you know, he's showing me things and he's telling me things, and he is, you know, I realized that he was vetting me to see if I knew what I did. And it took probably around 5 or 6 range sessions where I was on the line with him, where he handed it over to me. And then he's like, dude, you fucking got it. He's like, you have this. And I went in there with that humble attitude, but knowing what my background is and telling him what my background is. But until I could actually show him, that's whenever he was like, you got it. I don't need to hold your hand. I don't need to do anything with you. And it was probably one of the most enriching experiences that I have had. And like, him and I still talk to this day as friends. I mean, most of the time now we're just talking about bourbon and are you going to go to the local drop or something like that. But
that's cool.
You know, I would say, like, in the experience that I got there, seeing the change from some people who had never touched a handgun in their life and they're going to be an FBI agent, some of them didn't even know that they had to carry a gun, to, you know, by the end, 4 months later, and seeing how much improvement that there was, like guys that couldn't even hit targets at, you know, 3 to 7 yards away, and now they're rapidly engaging targets at 25 yards away. Seeing that growth, it's pretty amazing.
Well, it's definitely satisfying. That's why I like doing it. I mean, it's fun to create performance. And I tell everybody, I'm like, listen, you think I'm great. You have no idea what great is, but you have the ability to absolutely be as good and certainly better than me. And not everybody does, but a lot of people actually do. And it's pretty cool.
So in the episode at Gun Talk, you described an incident when training a seasoned police officer who was going through training who had a negligent discharge because he doesn't use his safety and the hammer was cocked. I had a very similar incident when training somebody in the Marine Corps. You know, and I would say the standards were relatively fair. Maybe for this group of people, we should have, you know, lowered the time standard for what we were doing. But literally, he came out of the holster and I saw his finger already on the trigger, which was fine, but he was fidgeting and he let a round off that went between my foot and his foot, like inches away from each other's foot. And I mean, to be honest with you, to give you context, my reaction was I looked at where I was watching where the round hit, looked at him, was like, well, we didn't get shot. Go ahead, you know, holster your pistol, just, you know, unload, show clear, holster. And then, hey, take 5 minutes, go drink some water, you know, finish the rest of the shooters off, got them through the drill. I walked back to where he was. I was like, you all right, man? He's like, I'm done. I'm not shooting this anymore. You know, I was like, hey, man, you're in day two of training. Like, we have 2 weeks left. He's like, no, I'm done. I quit. I was like, hey, bro, you're a staff sergeant. I was like people look up to you. I was like, you can't lose this level of confidence this early on. I was like, I'm going to get you back on the line. We're going to work this drill together, and I'm going to build your confidence up, because if you don't do this now, you'll think back on this moment for the rest of your life. And he went back out there, and I wouldn't say he was the best or the greatest, but he completed the competition, the training, and all that stuff, and overall he was better for it.
Well, there's no doubt about that. You did the right thing, but he had the right attitude. He just had an accent. The guy I was talking about was an absolute jerk off who refused to do what I told him to do. And when he cranked off that round, I looked at him and I said, I knew that was going to happen. And I just freaking left him alone after that. And I might have said some more about, hey, this is why I told you to do what I told you to do. The problem is most people don't want to hear it because most people just want to show you what they know. They don't want to learn anything. And honestly, as an instructor, I mean, I don't know if I've always had that the same the correct attitude, but people don't know how much they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I don't think he even knew that I cared. He was just an idiot. And honestly, stranger things have happened on the range. But have a friend that recently put a round through his hand after dry firing, and put one through the center of his hand. He feels absolutely horrible. And he's just a great guy, solid guy, the kind of man a man wants when a man needs a man, that kind of guy, like a freaking awesome, just a good person and skilled. And he just feels so bad about it. And I told him, I said, dude, we all make mistakes. I mean, I've had mine. I plugged myself once and I freaking been shot before. Shit happens. You move forward, you learn from it. It usually hurts your ego way more than it hurts your body, as long as you don't die. But yeah, I mean, you always like every ND I've had on the range, though. Like, there was a lieutenant out in Washington. I was training in Nose, Idaho, and the guy just was a hot shot. Kept catching his freaking bullet in the air, racked the gun, catch the bullet. He was the full Monty. And when we were unloading and clearing, I would tell everybody, I'd say, okay, shooters, pop an ear, take your ears off. All right, everybody unload, clear, remove the source of ammunition, run the slide several times, lock the slide to the rear, visually and physically inspect, look away, do it again. When you're satisfied, slide forward, press the trigger, get a good sight picture because it should be your best shot of the day. Nice sight picture, press the trigger, dry fire your gun. Man, he would do it every time. He'd do his thing and poo, and do his click thing, and he cranked off around. It was so funny because nobody was on. And I heard the round go off and I winced, and I looked down the line and I said, who the fuck was that? And Mr. Cocky had to timidly raise his hand, me. And I said, I knew that was going to happen. Just went on with it, but I never had a problem with them the rest of the week. I mean, it's a dangerous job. But like you said, you saw where the bullet landed, you looked at it, nobody was hurt, and you went, okay, go just clear your gun out for a little bit and take a break.
I think Alex Goking, one of the guys on the team, he was on the lane over, and he kind of saw everything that happened. And he looked at me, he's like, dude, I'm glad it was you that was over there, because you handled that better than anybody I would have known. I was like, dude, like,
It's like
what can you do?
here.
At that point, what can you do? And you know what we did afterwards? I pulled the three of us that were in training. I was like, hey, look, where did we come up with this standard for this time? I was like, and is the purpose of this drill to meet this time standard, or is the purpose of this drill to get them to, accurately, like, transition from rifle to pistol in a smooth manner? And we got, the coach who developed the drill, he was like, yeah, you're right, the purpose is to smoothly transition from rifle to pistol. I was like, let's adjust, for the remaining classes. not put that time standard on and rush them, and let's get them comfortable doing this transition, because we're teaching a bunch of guys that don't shoot nearly as much as we do.
Right. You got to learn the movements before you can do the muscling.
Mm-hmm.
Things about learning the movements before you interact with the muscling of it. I mean, and speed is, you know, you heard me say it probably on some other interview, but, you know, everybody says slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, it's bullshit, because slow is just slow.
Yeah, slow is slow, fast is fast, and you can accurately engage the target as fast as you are capable of doing. That's right. What I tell people.
Smooth is fast. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you don't be slow just to be slow. What you do is you operate properly, which is smoothly, and ultimately becomes the fastest reps that you've gotten, because there's no extraneous movements.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Very well said, Chris.
You should do it. Thanks. You should do everything as fast as you can correctly. But here's the other thing I say, and you can steal this one. I don't know if you've heard it before, but we strive for perfection. We settle at excellence. Everybody wants to be so perfect that they're unwilling to commit an error. So therefore they're slow and very purposeful and stupid about things. And you have to be willing to commit errors in your struggle for perfection, because otherwise you're never going to move fast enough. And Mike Sieglander pointed that out to me years ago in Atlantic City at the Air Marshal Academy. He called me Mr. Roboto. He said, man, you do everything in these steps and everything's just perfect. And he said, you just got to throw down, man, just flow. And that's when I truly learned about being just smooth, and how fast being smooth could be, and how slow that actually is when things are correct.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned the Air Marshal program, and listening to the podcast you did with Gun Talk Radio, that's something that was really interesting to me, just the entire experience. But, you know, you spent a decent amount of time in that program on a lot of flights, having to be, you know, having to notice things and like basically have your head on a swivel. What's something that you've noticed during your experiences with air travel that most people probably don't even pay attention to?
Honestly, I thought about this question for a bit, and I wrote down some notes, and it wasn't so much the things that I noticed, it was how I approached everything, you know. I approached things differently. I definitely never had a fear, no matter whatever happened in an airplane or what was going down, like with turbulence or touch and goes and weird stuff like that. So never any fear, because, you know, whatever's meant to be will be. I definitely learned that you can kill a lot of people with kindness. And I mean, you get a lot further, definitely, in an airport. And the other thing is always have a plan, you know. And I started learning to have a plan for different things, because, you know, your seat cushion is not just a flotation device. It's also a pretty damn cool air shield for a defense against edge weapons. And if your belt is pliable enough with a substantial buckle, you can create quite a bit of distance while wrapping somebody in the side of the head with your air shield as a defense against an edge weapon. And all those magazines that we don't get anymore were really cool body armor, because you could actually stuff those into your belt line to keep from getting gutted like a fish if someone did have an edged weapon. And, you know, just weird things that I learned over time and thought about, you know, because you spent so many hours sitting in there. But there wasn't, I noticed nothing. I learned a lot. Back in the day after 9/11, flying was different, because everybody was kind and aware and a little more. I mean, first class was definitely different. I mean, there was obviously assholes up there.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get drunk and stupid, but you could do anything you wanted to them, and you could say anything you wanted, because they didn't know who you were. And you were just a psycho passenger on this plane that was like, dude, if you do that again, I'm going to tie you in your seat. And they'd look at you and go, oh, shit. but they didn't know who you were. But yeah, I mean, those were good times. But I only did 3 years after 9/11. I went in, did it for 3 years, got pulled into the training. I was lucky to do what I did. I was part of the special missions group, where we followed, priority targets, things like that, or maybe provided extra security for, important people that were coming through the country. But yeah, I mean, if there's anything I learned, it was just, there's no fear up there because there's nothing you can do about anything. And then kill them with kindness, because kindness will get you a lot further when everything's going to shit on your day. And have a plan. I mean, don't underestimate the seat cushion.
Very good information to know. You did talk a little bit about the end of your time with the air marshals, and you basically mentioned that there was a personality conflict and that spurred your move to train law enforcement. I think you mentioned it was in Northern Ohio. I think, people nowadays, I think it's seldom that someone stays with the same career for most of their professional time. What are some general pieces of advice that you would give to people concerning career flexibility? And do you ever really trust an organization or company to be completely loyal to you as an employee?
All right, first and foremost, no one should ever take work advice from me, because I've quit more good jobs than most people have ever even thought about applying for. But nothing ventured, nothing gained. You got to be willing to take a risk, and without risk, there's no reward. As far as loyalty and in any job I've had, I mean, I've had some good times in a lot of my jobs, and some of them, I left almost all of them on good terms. I mean, the air marshal thing was stupid. They were going to put me back on the flight schedule due to my inability to effectively manage and get along with one of my coworkers, who I made cry a couple times. But he was special forces, so I mean, I expect to make all special forces guys cry. I mean, detect my sarcasm. Anyways, you are a finger in a glass of beer. And when you take your finger out of that glass of beer, that's the hole you leave. And that's the memory you have be left behind in any one of those positions. Yeah, that's probably deep and sad. Nobody wants to hear that shit.
But I think it's important, right? Because I think people do get invested in their careers, and I think nowadays in certain industries, it's normal for people to move jobs every 3 to 4 years. Certainly, my father, we grew up in Silicon Valley. My dad was a software engineer. He immigrated over from China on a visa, and like he changed companies multiple times throughout my childhood. And it was just a recurring thing.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, it seems like, I mean, we might as well get into the next question, but having jumped from job to job, you've experienced such a broadened perspective of the firearms industry, the air marshals, law enforcement training, the media and commercial sector, and most people tend to try to stick with what they know. I just want to know, after spending so much time,
Most people stick with what they know. You're right.
well, I mean, most people tend to they become comfortable, right? They get entrenched. There's a sunken cost in there. So after spending so much time in different parts of the industry, do you think that everybody would benefit from that journeyman experience if to a certain extent?
Well, everything that happened in my life has just been a series of fortunate events. I mean, I've always, like, when the air marshal thing happened, well, when 9/11 happened, I was a cop. And I guess they had, I don't know how many million people apply for that job. They hired X thousand. I was one. I was like, I want to go save the world. I don't care what happens. I'm going to make a little bit more money, and I'm going to do something really cool and fun. And then when that fell apart, I was looking for, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I can't go back to regular police work. Maybe I'll do something else. And I found the training job with the Ohio Peace Officer Training Academy. And there was 109 applicants. And I never in a million years would have thought. but I got that job. And then freaking Top Shot happened, you know, and it was like everything just kind of snowballed and just led to something more. When I was with the state, with the attorney generals for the academy, people were calling me after Top Shot all the time. They're like, hey, you know, you seem like you'd be really good at this, and we'd like you to do this, and we'd like you to do that. And I'd say, listen, I'm just a training guy from Ohio. I don't think I can do that. And I hung up on people for 6 months. I mean, I didn't know. And then I went to SHOT Show, my first one. And I was like, holy shit, this is what I want to do. So, you know, and then I was on food stamps for a year. I mean, we had an EBT card for an entire year, almost exactly to the date. We had an EBT card. And we just kept plugging away and fighting towards it. And I mean, dude, you cannot absolutely, if you want to do stupid shit like I did, you can absolutely not be a pussy, and you cannot be afraid. And you have to, and you also have to know when to say when. I mean, I took that job with Sky Firearms, which was obviously not my bag and definitely not something I could get behind. I tried to, I did my best. Because when you're there, you do your best. You do what's right for the company. But I took that job because I knew I was going to get divorced. I knew something was coming, and I needed this stability, you know? And I was lucky to get that job. I mean, you just treat people right, do the right things, and windows and doors just keep opening up. And I know that a lot of people get scared and they pass opportunities because, you know, my dad thought I was nuts. Mm-hmm. He's up there on the shelf, by the way, in a box. He's right there. He thought I was nuts. He's like, why don't you just stay and get your retirement and do this and do that? And, you know, and can't you just, I mean, golly, you know, you have a nice pension and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I thought, I'll fucking kill myself if I have to drive around in circles in a police car for 30 years. You know, I don't know. So I did different things. And so I've made my bed and I lay in it and I don't mind. I have no regrets, but I know it's not for everybody. And it, I mean, I'm sure it put a nail or two in the coffin of my marriage. But you know, you guys are great. Thanks.
Yeah, those career paths are not always linear, right? There's ups, there's downs, there's detours, there's U-turns. Sometimes you pull off the highway and you do donuts in the parking lot a little bit. But
I love to learn, man. I just love new experiences. I love new things, and I love to learn.
Yeah. So, speaking of that, I do have a follow up. I don't think this was part of the list that we sent you originally, but you've experienced so many different parts.
You sent a list of questions?
We did. As we always do. But
thanks for telling everybody.
we're not cloak and dagger about it at all. Yeah, but you've experienced so many different types of competition in different parts of the industry. Is there like a certain type of competition or part of the industry that you've haven't really experienced and would like to get into at this point?
Well, there's nothing that I would like to do, I don't think. Honestly, I would love to shoot three gun again. I would love to be able to do that and just get out and be wild and free again. I miss that. I miss the people. But one of the things I've also learned in all those moves I made across my life is that you can never go back. It's never the same. I mean,
you
as many
go
things,
back to three gun.
I was
Chris,
I went
in one.
I went and shot a match in South Carolina a couple of years ago. And
I remember because
we were there. You were there. I mean, how many familiar faces did you see? Like 10?
Yeah. But like I remember I was walking out of registration or something like that, and you're like, what's up, Matt? I'm looking at you and I'm just in awe. I'm like,
what are you doing?
I was like, holy shit, Chris, how you been, man? And then gave you a hug. And I was like, hey, I got to take care of some stuff. And then you drove down the road stopped and we were just sat there drinking a beer, probably for 25, 30 minutes, just catching up.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what I enjoy about it.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
I could do without all the meatheads.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, don't ever mistake my kindness for weakness, but don't ever expect me to have to prove that to you. Cause I just want to have fun. I like smiling. Smiling's my favorite. I'm never going to make work my favorite. Smiling's my favorite. Buddy the Elf. But anyways, I like having a good time. I try to do the best that I can. I'm not a smart man. I'm definitely not a gamer or a stage planner. I just like going out and shooting targets and then giggling about it.
Good a reason as any to get into competition. With all the different experiences that you've had throughout your career in competition shooting, do any preconceived notions come up that you thought about before you got into teaching, before you got into reality TV media, that really changed after you got involved with those sectors?
Oh my God. So here's some more freaking, I guess some more whitewash bullshit, man. I don't have any preconceived notions about much, especially anymore, you know, because I'm 54 years old. There's one thing I've known from day one, because I mean, I had my first cop job and I thought about getting a different one and, you know, things like that, because you always see other things. One thing I know for sure is that the grass is very rarely greener on the other side. You can make more money. You can always make more money.
But you're going to be working harder.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be something. There's always some kind of give and take. I could really care less. Like law enforcement was exactly what I wanted to be until I left it. One thing that has come to me over the years is that there was always going to be somebody that you can't trust. There's always going to be someone who wants to break it off in your ass. They're going to steal your stuff. They're going to freaking say anything they can to make you look bad, to include any kind of lie and embellish the truths. I mean, the truths are going to be bad enough, but they're going to embellish them too. You know, there's always going to be somebody, and you have to always watch for somebody trying to screw you. And that's a sad thing. Problem is, I really trust a lot of people, but then I say stupid shit like, hey, listen, I really like you, but if you fuck me, I'm going to be really pissed off. I'll probably kill you. Like, I'll say shit like that to people, and they think you're an asshole for saying it, but they don't realize that you mean it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I enjoy having you around. I enjoy sharing my stuff with you. I enjoy sharing my life with you. I think that we work great together. I would love to push you out in front of me, because if you can go out in front of me, you absolutely should go in front of me. But if you backdoor me, I'm going to be pissed off and disgusted. And of course, disappointed in myself, because any more these days, you'd like to think you could pick them out before they get you. So there's some preconceptions.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's just a thing. I mean, Matt's gone through it too. You trust people until you can't anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been there many times.
Yes.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yes. But the last question I had for you was, it's going to be a tumultuous year. Ammunition's already starting to get more expensive, and we're probably going to deal with some more scarcity issues coming up. So any advice that you would give a novice shooter interested in pursuing competitions, or just someone looking to get into self-defense training?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought about that question too. And I can tell you this, on the back side of my sheet, now that we've divulged that there was a question sheet, I did make some notes. You know what? I've always bought ammo in quantity when I see good prices. I'm still hung up on like $165 for 1,009 with $5 flat rate shipping. I'm still hung up on that. So I have a problem with that. But when I was buying that, and I would buy, five, six, 10,000 rounds at a time, everybody looked at me like I had a freaking dick grown out of my forehead, or like I was rich. I have never been rich. A fool and his money are soon parted. One thing I do know is that when there's a deal, you stock up. I don't know what today's deals are because every time I look at them, I just get all wincy and flinchy. So, people are like, oh, if I had your kind of money, I'd buy that too. And I'm thinking, I don't have money, but I also know that I'm going to need this ammo for the next year or two because I tend to be pretty thrifty. And since I don't practice, which Matt knows and pointed out already, I can make ammo last a good long time. So what I would do is I would absolutely buy what you can now. There was a point when I did start reloading and I reloaded 9 and 223, and I did it. I don't know how much it saved me. It took time, it took effort, but I had a guy that would, process my brass for me, and he would clean it and he would prime it and everything, which was great. But man, if you see a deal, buy it. If you think it's a deal, buy it. Stockpile it. Don't worry about you have. Don't ever think you have enough, unless of course you're going to quit shooting and quit competing and quit doing stuff. I mean, that's fine. There's a lot of people that do that. They're like, oh, I'm going to do this for a year, and then I'm going to sell all this shit. I don't know, man. It's going to be a weird year. I mean, we're feeling it in the TV industry. We can't even get ammo. We're having a hard time even buying ammo to do classes where I'm at or to even do on TV.
Yeah, definitely. I'm in the same mindset. I know Matt is as well. Like right now, the 223 prices are pretty exorbitant based on what they have been, but that's as good as they're going to get. They're probably only going to get worse, and you're going to have to work harder to find good prices out there. So yeah, and I think in general that mindset of just buying things in advance and being proactive for things that you know you're going to end up using anyway, for things that are about to get scarce, just shows a little bit of forethought. And it's the right way to approach things, especially with our hobby as the way it is, especially in this particular year. With that
Yeah.
being said, go ahead.
If you can't afford it now, you're not going to be able to afford it later.
Right.
It's like everybody that says, "Oh, I can't have kids. I'm not ready to have kids. I'm not ready to buy a house. I'm not ready to buy a car. I can't buy a car because of this, because of that." Dude, every year it goes on, that problem still exists.
It just gets
Sooner
more
or later,
expensive.
you just do it. Sooner or later, you just do it, and you're like, "Oh shit, I guess it wasn't that bad. I mean, I'm getting through it."
Yeah, absolutely. But that wraps up everything that we had for you. Anything else you want to leave for the audience, Chris?
No, it was good. It was nice to meet you, Frank, and Matt. You look fantastic. Did I tell you that yet?
No,
He's had
not today. I
had
mean,
a
post-retirement glow up for sure.
you look really good. I don't know if you have a big fat dip in your jaw right now, but
He does. He does.
I
He
mean,
does.
your beard is good. You got a little white in there. It's showing all kinds of like wisdom.
That
I
I
look like a
don't
disaster,
have.
man. This morning, I got up. I threw on a t-shirt. I probably dragged a washcloth across my head. I didn't do anything to my hair. Listen, if we're not filming something at work and there's nothing major going on, I have one mirror in my house. I don't usually look in it, and I'm out the door. And I've and this is my life. It's awesome, man. And I get to do really cool shit. I'm like 1%, if you think about it, Matt, of all the things you could do in the gun industry. I'm probably a 1%er. Because how many people get to do the TV, the travel,
The
still get to
instructing.
shoot matches, teaching, writing, stuff, all that? Like, who get? I mean, dude, it's a full-time job.
It's a dream job.
I can't even believe I get paid to do it. Don't let Ryan hear that though, because Ryan will be like, "Good, I've been wanting to cut your salary anyways."
Well, really appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us, Chris. For everyone listening, this is Chris Serino. There's two episodes. He does an interview on Gun Talk Radio. Go check out that podcast. It's very well done, gives you an insight into his background and what he's been through. For the rest of our listeners, let us know how we're doing, and we'll see you on the next one.